I'm excited to announce that I'll be the MC of Design XL, a new design conference taking place November 9th in beautiful Pensacola, Florida. Design XL is the Florida Panhandle's first design conference. Join me in this beach town as they feature both local and national talent to excel your skills, grow your network, and further your design education. Tickets are on sale now at designxl.org. And early bird pricing will get you all access for a limited low price of $129 for professionals and $75 for students. In addition to the day of conference, there will be a pre-party mixer on the night of November 8th. Visit designxl.org for all the details on speakers, workshops, and more. Welcome to Feasting on Design. I'm your host, Jason Frostholm. Today, I'm talking with Maggie Gagliardi, an educator and illustrator based out of Connecticut. We chat about balancing work and life while teaching at multiple universities and maintaining a professional practice, developing both technical and conceptual skills, and creating beer packaging for multiple brands, plus a whole lot more. Maggie, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So let's dive in. Tell me a little bit about yourself. Where did you grow up? Where are you from? How did you start life?
I am from Central Connecticut. I've been drawing since forever, since as long as I can remember. I've been involved in art, so that's kind of defined my whole life.
Sure.
Let's see. Growing up, I had a brother who was a musician, so he was learning to play the concertina as we were growing up, which is, if you don't know, a smaller version of an accordion. So that was fun.
Now I want to interview your brother just because that is a weird instrument to pick.
Yeah, I'll hook you up with him. He's in a Irish folk band.
Which makes sense if you play concertina.
Yeah. So there was that. I played a lot of sports. I loved soccer growing up. That was like my team sport. But art was always like the thing for me. Like I could never stray away from it. Even if I got distracted for a little while, I would still be drawing regardless. Even in like high school, I could mimic anything. That's one of my skills. So I would mimic like early dismissal notes and like get paid in cookies from the cafeteria from students, fellow students.
So if you had an evil bent in your body, you would have led a life of crime, forging documents and, you know, all that stuff you see on the FBI and CSI shows.
Yeah, that would be my one skill. but back then it was all about the cookies. The cookies from the cafeteria. Yep. Yeah, and then I went to art school, of course. Mm-hmm. I almost decided that art wasn't a career. But my like second half of my senior year of high school, I was like, okay, there's nothing else I could possibly do. So sure. I'm going to do what inspires me the most. And at the time, it was movies. I think when I was going into college, the first Pirates of the Caribbean came out. And I was kind of obsessed with that one. For the special effects more than anything else. I remember watching like the DVD, the extra DVD that came with the movie to see how they do all the monster makeup and stuff. So for a little while I thought about doing the makeup route. And then I decided my biggest skill is my drawing. I could draw really fast. I can draw really accurate. So I went for animation and I went to the School of Visual Arts in New York City. And I did traditional animation by hand. It was fun for a little while, but again, I was mostly drawing other people's stuff rather than designing my own characters, which is what I've always done and what I still do. That's my like true love is designing characters. So I decided that I was going to put that aside, went to a smaller school where I studied illustration. And kind of found my love there.
Were you when you went to that other school to do illustration, were you focusing on more character driven stuff, or were you just kind of getting the general basics of illustration?
I actually started off training in like fine arts. So I say I'm classically trained coming from this school because it was a very traditional school in comparison. Sure. So I was doing some hyper-realistic paintings, the typical foundation studies, which is really important.
Yes.
And then, yeah. And then I hopped into their illustration program, which was definitely character-based, story-based, which is what illustration is. And kind of found my place there for sure. Between the storytelling and the character designing and putting those characters into environments, turning my characters, in a sense, animating them through a book versus actual animation. Sure. So that was a lot of fun for me. After that, I did grad school. I took a year off, and then I went to grad school at the University of Hartford in West Hartford, Connecticut. And at the time, I did not realize it, but I was actually the youngest person to ever get into this program. Really? Yeah. So I showed up for class the first day, and it was me, and I was like 22, and there's the second youngest person was like 28. And yeah, it was all like industry professionals and faculty and people that had been in the industry for a long time coming back to like get a refresher or to get a master's so they could teach. But that's one thing I always knew that I wanted to do was teach.
Okay. Is that specifically why you went for a master's?
Yeah. Yeah. Teach and just to learn a few more things that I didn't think I got a grasp on in undergrad, which would be like at the time, digital art. I didn't have a good background in that back then.
I understand.
So I did get a little bit more of that in grad school, but mostly it has been something I've learned for myself. But grad school also built a lot of relationships that I still have today. Definitely, don't want to say changed the person that I am, but made me a better version of myself, like a stronger version, more confident going out into the world and being able to nonetheless compete with my colleagues and or classmates and kind of be right up there with them. So I definitely had more confidence in that after grad school.
Gotcha.
And then after that, I did theater for a while. Actually, through grad school, I paid for grad school doing theater. So I did a lot of scenic design at a local theater. And I was up on ladders and doing these large scale projects. And it was a lot of fun.
I have a friend who does background painting for movies and stuff, but but she's out of Austin, so it's background paintings that shoot in Texas, for films that shoot in Texas, well, which feels very specific. I mean, I know Austin's got a pretty big film market because Robert Rodriguez has his studio there and films a lot of stuff out of there, but it just seemed like a very specific place to go to do background paintings.
That's kind of cool though.
Yeah.
It's definitely a tough one because it kills your back. You can only do it for so long. But once in a while I pick it up from time to time. I'm supposed to be working on one possibly in the next year, an off-Broadway show, which has kind of been in the works for, I don't know, maybe 10 years now.
So off Broadway.
Off Broadway, building up back to Broadway. Who knows? Who knows if it'll ever happen? But it's fun to be a part of something like that and just get updates. You never know.
Gotcha. So after the theater bug leaves you and you, I'm assuming quickly learned you can't make a ton of money doing that.
Yep.
Do you go seeking out a teaching job? Because I know you're doing like three teaching jobs at one time now. So I'm trying to lead you down to figure out how you balance that.
Yeah. So it's been pretty crazy. Right out of grad school, I actually did get a teaching job at my alma mater, which was Pear College of Art in Hamden, Connecticut. Mm-hmm. So I taught there for some time. I taught pretty much every class you can possibly teach. I've taught life drawing, I've taught art history, business, digital. There's probably more, painting, life painting. I've done it all. But sure. After that, 3.5 years ago, I picked up a job at Sacred Heart University where I started their digital illustration program, which has been like my baby that I've been molding. It's the first time it's been implemented there, and the students are really like picking up on it. It's definitely a heavy graphic design based student body. So it's good that they're able to get this edge on the illustration market to combine with their graphic skills.
I wish someone had pushed me in that direction when I was in college.
Yeah. I mean, nowadays, like I say, I call myself a commercial artist. I don't even say illustrator because I have to do it all. There's between. I didn't go to school for graphic design, but I do it because I have to. And I figured out how to do it along the way. But I also, I've taught many a class, many a place. I just finished my last semester at the New Hampshire Institute of Art in Manchester, New Hampshire. So I taught there for about 3 years. And again, I taught a bunch of classes. I taught digital. I taught avenues of illustration. I started a concept art class there, which is still going today, which is doing really well. So I'm super happy to be able to put that into place. And I also taught a senior studio class, which is senior portfolio. I team taught that with my department head, Ryan O'Rourke. We taught that together for three rounds, I think. But yeah, this was my last semester there. So I'm cutting back on the crazy back and forth. I'm going to maintain a spot with my digital program at Sacred Heart because it's the closest one to me. But yeah, I'm going to fall back and focus more on the art, which is going really well these days. So I want to keep pushing it as much as I can.
Gotcha. As you're coming up and doing all this, you know, aside from teaching, you've got, I mean, even as, because I know a little bit about how academia works, even as a teacher, you've got to maintain basically a practice to count as research for you.
Yes.
So how are you, because I looked at your website and I looked at one time you were teaching at three universities at the same time.
Yeah.
How are you maintaining balancing, you know, unless they're all within walking distance, which I don't imagine they are since they were in, you know, one's in New Hampshire and two are in different parts of Connecticut.
Yep.
You know, how are you maintaining that schedule and still keeping a commercial practice going, and still having a life since you know, your tech support / fiance was just in there helping you with the computer a second ago. How are you maintaining all of that and balancing all of that?
It's tough. I say I'm kind of a crazy person. I don't know anybody that has anywhere near the drive that I have. I'm hyper-focused on anything and everything that I want to get done, and it always gets done. Even going into a job, like I always say to myself and to students, like, it's going to get done and it's going to get done on time because it has to. Like, there's no other way. And that's the same with like the teaching. Luckily, the time I was all over the place at three different schools, one of those was an online course. So that worked out well.
That makes it a little easier.
Yeah, that made it a little easier. But I mean, it still is a balance. I have learned to manage my time very well. But the courses I teach too, they're things that I do like in my daily life. So I'm not necessarily planning every day, every class. I kind of go in and know where we're at and where we need to go. And that's how the class flows. And the portfolio class is basically just critiquing and giving input versus teaching lessons. And even the way I teach class too, I go around to each individual person versus like doing a big demo and having them sit and watch me for an hour. I go to each one and I show them how to do it. And then I let them basically play for the rest of the class. But
gotcha.
And in regards to client work.
With, Yeah, sorry, go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off.
I don't know. I just get it done.
When it comes to especially the teaching stuff, you know, you were building curriculums too. It's not like you were going in and these were set classes. You were literally creating them from the ground up, which is a lot more work than going in somewhere as an adjunct professor where they already have a set curriculum and, you know, have a class and is basically here, teach it this way. This is, you know, here's the exercises. Here's the lessons. Let's do that.
Yeah.
So that's more than just a part-time job.
Yeah, I know. Like I said, I'm a crazy person, but I love it. And I love the challenge, I guess, to bring something fresh and new to a place that really needs it. A lot of schools these days, they're kind of, again, still in that traditional format. And it needs to change because that's not what the market is. So if I can bring something to that program that can push it in the right direction so that the students are getting the education they need to be successful, then I'm more than happy to do it. And it's so
fun. How do you see the future of education evolving with that? Since, like you said, the market is very much changing. And, you know, especially in what we do, I think there's a trend that's moving away from you don't have to have a degree anymore. Like you can be self-taught and be very successful. And there's lots of people out there. I mean, if you want to work in-house at a very corporate job, you need a degree but eventually they're going to start looking past those too. How do you keep up with that?
It's a thing. Enrollment has been down quite a bit in the past few years, especially in art school. It's always lower than a normal school. But there is, I think it's picking up this semester at the schools that I've taught at. It's a complicated question because if you're self-taught, you're not getting the networking that you would get being in a classroom with those your peers and your faculty who are working in the industry. And like everywhere I've taught, we bring in speakers, we bring in special guests that you can meet and interact with. So I think that's an important aspect. But I mean, the creative world is tough regardless whether you have a degree or not. I think it's important depending on, again, the avenue you want to take. If you're going to be more of a designer, then I would say, yes, you probably want to have at least a bachelor's. Illustration is a little different. I mean, it's a tight knit community. Everybody knows everybody's work in some way or another. So it's kind of like keeping up with the Joneses in a way, not necessarily competition, but just like, are you going to be as marketable as the next person? And what do you need to do to get there? But if you want to teach, you do need a master's. A lot of creatives teach because it's, you know, a dependable paycheck. It's a chance to like get outside of my little bubble, which is my studio and my own head, and like interact with other creatives. Bounce ideas off them and just have conversations that I wouldn't have just sitting here in my studio with my dog. So there's push and pull there. I mean, I know like tuition is crazy everywhere and everybody's going to be paying off loans for the rest of their life, but it's worth it. It is. I mean, I wouldn't change what I did. I'm happy the path that I took, and it's definitely helped me grad school more than undergrad, but I wouldn't be able to do grad school if I didn't do undergrad. So
sure. Yeah.
It all depends, I guess.
Gotcha. Well, so as you're doing this and with the commercial practice, how do you define your style? When does your style become defined to you?
When did it or when does it?
Yes.
Okay. That's the question. Let's talk about when did it first.
Okay.
What does it, if that makes sense. So
I'm following you.
All right. So I started off again, like traditional. Mm-hmm. And then I wanted to break into the digital world. I started that with my thesis project in grad school. And then I did that in Photoshop, but for some reason I jumped into Illustrator, which is vector, and really kind of conquered that avenue. So I am typically known for specializing in vector. So I get a lot of vector jobs that another artist who doesn't have the knowledge of that, because a lot of artists, digital artists, prefer Photoshop over Illustrator.
Sure.
So I can do both. But I was heavy into Illustrator for a long time. And that kind of defined my style for a long time. And then I bounced over to Photoshop with this series I've been creating. You probably saw these monsters, these Bigfoot monsters, these highly detailed things. I started that actually in my sketchbook, and I started doing this crazy detailed drawing. I was like, oh, I want to color it now. I'm going to scan it in and struggle coloring it in Photoshop. So I actually found a brush from those Kyle Webster brushes that I thought would be perfect for what I was doing. And I started to outline. And in doing that, somehow that allowed me to loosen up. Because working vector, you're very tight, you're very clean. And these drawings that I was starting to do were very messy in a way. They don't look it, but if you look close, it's just scribble. So in kind of loosening up with that Photoshop method I was doing, that started to define a new style for me, which is what has become the most marketable style for me in all my years of doing this, which is, again, going back to what I talked about early on, that drawing was my strong suit. And now I'm heavily relying on my drawings again, and they're kind of leading the way for me. So hopefully that answered that question.
Yeah.
In a way.
So, no, yeah, it definitely does. When you're, you know, because there's the technical aspect of style, which you were just talking about, but there's also the conceptual aspect of style. When did your conceptual aspect come into play and kind of, I don't want to say solidify, because if you're a good illustrator and, you know, I've seen your work and you are, you know, that it's always kind of amorphous and it will evolve, hopefully evolve and continue to evolve. And sometimes it goes in different directions and all. But when did the conceptual part of what you were doing, and we'll just take the Sasquatch series as an example, when did that come into play for you?
It's something I've had it in the back of my mind for a long time, not necessarily like the Sasquatch aspect, but the idea of drawing monsters. I always had this thing for monsters, because you're creating something out of nothing. You can piece together five different animals and make a new one.
You don't have to worry about anatomy being perfect.
Exactly. But there's no kind of limitation on like how much imagination can go into something like that. And everything I do, I've always tried to push the weird or bizarre or some kind of funky pun I'll throw into my work that nobody else will get but me. but I know it's there, and that's what matters. But I don't know. I was just on one of my drives going up to New Hampshire, and I just told this story recently. And the idea of just Spaghetti Yeti just popped into my head. I was like, oh, that had to have been done before. Like, that's so silly, but whatever. So I was staying at my friend's house, and we looked it up, and there was nothing really there for Spaghetti Yeti other than some silly drawing. So the next day in class, I actually started drawing it as like a demo in between critique. So I started drawing that in class, and then it came out really good. And this was the one I was talking about that I started my sketchbook, scanned in, and kind of redrew. So I did all that and put that piece out there, and it started getting awards, and I had never gotten awards for my work before. So it was super exciting to like actually get recognized for something I've done, but also it's like the absolute silliest thing I've ever done.
Sure.
But that's how things work.
Yeah.
But then from there, I would enter a lot of like open calls for shows, and there was an open call for, it was a gallery in New York, and it was something about pollution. And I was like, oh, I'm going to create a monster that speaks on polluting the ocean. So I created the sea squatch, which is this monster that came out of the ocean that was on the beer can. I didn't finish it in time for the show because I didn't realize how much I was putting into this. There's so much detail in there, and I couldn't stop. I just had to keep going. So that was how I got to two. And I was like, oh, I did two. I'm going to keep this going because I'm absolutely loving this. I've never had more fun doing any other piece of art than these two things I've just done. So I'm going to keep going. Then it kind of grew, and then each one of them started to pull in like recognition again, which is crazy because never anything before that. So now I have like five pieces that all have a list of awards to their name. And I was like, oh, I'm just going to keep going. and then I got the Collective Arts beer can with the sea squatch. And I got another Collective Arts can with the skunk cabbage ape.
I would have called him the hot monster, but okay.
The hot pink monster. They all have their own identities. But yeah, the goal with that is now it's going to be a 20-piece series that I want to turn into like a coffee table book.
Oh,
just
cool.
Like to speak to the amount of hours that went into this. They probably take like 3 months each, like balancing, teaching and client work and I'm renovating a house right now, so
sleeping.
Yeah, sleeping is important.
Yeah,
eating too. But
yeah.
So I'm on number 13.
Wow.
Yeah, it's been almost 3 years.
Wow.
Yeah. So
walk me through how the Collective Arts beer stuff happened. How did that come about?
I had been doing the open calls for a while, and I had been entering my vector stuff, my vector style. And I never got anything back. And then on a whim, I was like, oh, I'm going to just put in one of these guys and see what happens. They're doing well. Let's just see if something happens. And I put in the sea squatch for the open call, and he got picked. And that was awesome. And then they do like an open call every 3 months or something. So the next round I put in the hot pink monster, and I enter stuff and I forget about it and move on with my life. But then they got back to me and they had chosen that one for like a specialty can, collaboration can with Aslan Beer Co. out of Virginia, I think. And that was like a very limited release. I actually had to go to New York City to get it because they didn't have it anywhere else. Oh. But then after that, I have one that's out now with them and another one coming out in the next series, but all in that Sasquatch series. Those are the ones that are going on those cans.
Okay.
But I'm actually working on a mural right now with Collective Arts at Elm City Social in New Haven, which is the only rooftop bar in New Haven. And it's a rooftop tiki bar.
Ooh,
so
nice.
We're doing a, I'm going to do a live painting of that next Tuesday. They're going to launch their gin line. They started making gin. So there's going to be a big party for that. So I've been trying to get that mural to a point where I can live paint it and finish it on time because it's quite large. It's on the side of a building on brick, which has been challenging.
I can imagine.
Yeah. And then, let's see, and that same week, I'm doing another event with them where I'm going to live paint two canvases and auction them off.
You are braver than I am. I am not, like, I'm fast when I'm doing digital.
Yep.
Because I got my start out of college working for a print shop. So, like, production, I can crank stuff out. And I, mm-hmm. when I'm doing stuff digital, but when I'm, like, drawing stuff or, well, I don't do painting, but because I realized very quickly, and I wanted to be a painting major.
Yeah.
And realized very quickly I was not very good at painting. But that doing it fast is not something that comes naturally to me. Like, I, when we did life drawings and stuff like that, my very, at the time, ancient little Japanese woman drawing instructor who was mean as, I don't know what, an angry cat, always criticized me for that. She's like, just telling me I drew too slow. And I'm like, yeah, I'm aware. Not trying to win any awards for speed records here. Yeah, just trying to get it done.
Yeah. It's definitely going to have to not be my detailed style. It'll definitely fall back on the vector style, which is broken down into shape and sometimes line and just big blocks of color. Mm. It's the only way to get that done.
So Collective Arts comes about, and you've done some beer packaging with that. Is that how the other beer packaging stuff that you've done came into play? Did it kind of all spawn off the first Collective Arts piece?
Actually, no. I actually started off at Soundview Brewing, which is in Old Lyme, Connecticut. They're a small little place. And I started doing, like, landscapes, basically, mm-hmm. for their beer cans, which is kind of out of the realm of what I usually do. But I wanted to break into the market a little bit and just, like, format the labels and see how it all works. And they were just starting off, so it was a good match. So I started off with them. And then Collective Arts came into play. And then after that, the last one was Front Porch Brewing, which is in Wallingford, Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And I've done two with them so far. But they're local, those two. But I do work in different, a little bit of a different spin on my style for each place that I do. So Soundview, again, was more traditional looking, more classic style, like Sierra Nevada type stuff. And Front Porch is more like rendered painting,
right,
for their labels. And then the Collective Arts cans is more drawing based. I also did, let's see, Two Roads Brewing, which is in Stratford, Connecticut. I won their Con Artist 2017. So for anybody that goes into their tap room, my piece is on a big beer fermenter in the tasting room. So that's pretty cool. But that, again, it's a variation on the drawing style, but not quite the same.
Sure.
So let's see what else. And then, next week is going to be a crazy week for me. But on top of the Collective Arts stuff, next week, I actually did do a piece for Austin Street Brewery, which is in Portland, Maine. And it's the same style as the Sasquatch Monsters, but it's a sea monster made out of aluminum cans. And it's a 3D installation, and it's 8 feet long. I know.
8 feet long?
Yeah. Wow. But I did it digitally and had it printed, so it wasn't too crazy. It just took me the typical time period it would take. Painting that by hand would have been absolute hell.
Yeah, I can imagine. So as you get to work with more beers and companies like that, you know, you start having to be able to differentiate your style, which, you know, with the Soundview, is it Soundview?
Soundview. Soundview. Yeah.
Can't read my own writing.
It's okay. I can't read mine half the time.
With the Soundview, I looked at that stuff on the web, on your website, and like you said, it's much more traditional. It's very Sierra Nevada sort of esque in style and all that. How are you changing your mindset from, like, the monster stuff, which is obviously something that is a passion of yours, and you can tell by the amount of detail and all yeah. that goes into it versus going into something that is much more like a commission piece of, you know, somebody wants it in this style and I'm going to yeah. meet their style expectations. How are you? Because a lot of illustrators don't have that ability. Like it's few and far between of illustrators who will break out of their own style to mm-hmm. do other stuff.
Yeah.
How do you start differentiating between styles when you're working with so many different breweries?
Well, for the more traditional look, again, it's drawing based, so it's not that far of a stretch for me. It's obviously not the topic I'm used to doing or prefer to be
and
doing.
That's where I was going with that.
But again, that was something I wanted to do to kind of break into the market. I actually had no idea what it was going to be when I had my first meeting for them. And I have all these crazy ideas all the time. And they're like, oh, no, we want to keep it simple. But with them, too, they actually have kind of transformed along with me. They've okay. grown into taking a little bit more of a risk with my style, which I think they've benefited from. Because they're also working in the same place as the other brewery that I do work for. It's called
like
the Beer
literally
X.
The same physical
yeah,
location.
It's called the Beer X. It's like, I think there's like four or five small batch brewers that work out of the same like warehouse. It's a warehouse mm-hmm. and a tasting room. So you can go there and you can do tastings from all the breweries that are brewing in this place. So they all like interact and know each other.
Sure.
But I'm getting off topic.
No, that's fine.
Taking on projects that you don't necessarily want to do. If there's the incentive, like with that, where it's something I want to break into, I will take it. But I'm getting mm-hmm. to the point where it's kind of painful to take stuff that I don't want to do. And
sure.
at this point, I don't really have to because the stuff I'm doing that I'm passionate about is what's getting me the work that I want to do. And I sell a lot of prints of this stuff too. So I make more money off of the prints on a daily basis than sometimes I do the client work that
yeah.
would be painful for me to do. So I
understand how licensing works. Yes.
Yeah. I'm kind of starting to just kind of step away from a lot of it. Turning down things that I don't necessarily want to do, not taking as many private commissions unless it's like somebody I know that wants something for their wedding. Like that's their wedding present. I will draw your invitations. That's sure. your wedding present. trying to kind of just do what I want to for once. And it's kind of freeing and terrifying at the same time.
But, gotcha. How do you deal with it when somebody approaches you because they've seen your style, they've seen what you do, and they give you a blue sky brief where it's just whatever you want? How do you deal with that? Because for me, that's terrifying. Like, I want boundaries. Give me boundaries, and then mm-hmm. I will find ways to push them and break them. But I've got to have that box to be able to break out of.
I could do either, but when somebody tells me just go for it, it's like the whole world opens up in my brain, and it kind of like whittles down to whatever this bizarre idea I can possibly come up with. So I actually like that. I think it's exciting, and having no boundaries means who knows what can happen, but that's what I do with Front Porch. They just give me the title of the beer and mm-hmm. say, whatever the hell you want to do.
Gotcha.
And it's like, all right, let's do it. Let's be weird. And they totally embrace the weird there. So I can appreciate that.
Well, and their beer titles are kind of...
Oh, they're amazing.
they're odd names, too. So yep. it gives you... But that's the whole thing is, by them giving you the name of the beer, they are giving you a boundary in that sense. And it is providing a direction for you to bounce off of.
True, true.
Have you ever had the example where you know, the client has come to you and said, hey, we don't even have a name for this yet, but we want you to make a beer label for, you know, say this style of beer. Let's just, I realize that is a little bit of direction. But
there's always going to be some form of direction.
Yeah. But you've got to be a real kind of beer nerd to be able to differentiate between, you know, the 17 different styles of IPA that it could be.
Yeah. I mean, that would be awesome. I would totally be able to come up with something. I don't know what, but you know, sure. any challenge I'm up for. I just, I'm actually working on branding a barbecue restaurant in Philadelphia. So here comes in the design. So one of my biggest clients who I've been with for a while is Chef Brian Duffy. He used to be on Bar Rescue, and he has a podcast called Duffified Live that I help him with. And so he just is working on, I don't even know if I should be talking about it. I think it's coming out. But basically, he sent me a sketch.
By the time this goes live, I'm pretty sure perfect. It will be out.
I mean, I think he's already open. I just don't think. He told me yesterday he ordered like stickers, and I had just done a sketch of the logo. I was like, not yet. Chill. But he had sent me an idea that he wanted to have like the letter Q with a pig, but the Q was a tail or something. But in his sketch, he wrote in the word feathers, like near the pig. And he was showing me the reference of some colors he liked on like rooster feathers. But when I saw his sketch, I thought, like in my brain, like, oh, a pig with feathers, a pig turning into a rooster, a pig, like half pig, half cow, half rooster. Like, there's so much that we could do with this. So, like, I sent him the sketch of this basically like monster pig. And I was like, I don't think this is what you're talking about, but this is where my mind went. And he loved it. So there's going to be a very strange logo for this barbecue place, but again,
gotcha,
it's fun.
Gotcha. Well, you'll have to share that with us when it officially becomes live.
Will do.
As you start working with more and more clients who are in, you know, the beer industry and the food industry and things like that, is that where, you know, because you like creating monsters and all that, Is that where your passion in creating things for your personal business lies, in that kind of direction as far as the clients, the type of clients you want to work with?
Yeah. You know, it's really funny. Like when I started out, that was like the furthest thought from my mind was to be anywhere near like advertising. I started off wanting to work on movies. Like every kid going to college for art wants to work for Disney. I didn't want to work for Disney. I wanted to work for DreamWorks because I always wanted to work for the other person to build them up, to make them better. But
I don't think at this point, after all the mergers, it's impossible to even
compete. It doesn't matter. Disney. Not anymore.
They own half the world.
Yeah. Yeah. but let's see. But I kind of just like fell into this. I've been doing stuff for like this market for years now, and I do really love it. I don't know why, and I never thought I would, but it's something about like seeing your thing on a shelf, like that other people walk by every day or people buy or people have in their house. It's like, I said this before, it's like the biggest gallery in the world, really. I mean, these collective arts cans, they're international. I get stuff from like Europe and Canada and all over the place of people holding up my beer can. It's like, oh, people actually like see it and recognize it and appreciate it. I don't know. I do like the food and beverage industry. I think it's a really cool place because it's a really neat community to be in right now with all the small batch brewers and even the big ones. Like, everybody works together. Everybody's fighting for the same thing. And it's, I don't know, it's exciting.
Gotcha. I know for me, one of the things that's nice about it is, there is creativity that comes in with being a brewer or a chef or things like that. So when I'm working with them, they have a sense of creativity in what they do. So they tend to be more open to creative ideas coming from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just, it makes the process a lot more fun for me.
Yeah. Well,
they may not be able to describe visually what they want,
mm-hmm.
but if you can get them to describe something in whatever their medium is, you know, you can see them open up, and I can kind of gather information from their passion. And, you know, I mean, in college, I worked in the restaurant industry and worked for a brewery and all that stuff. So I know a little bit about that language anyways.
Mm-hmm.
Plus they're all kind of rebels and misfits too.
Yeah.
So they like to push buttons, which I think as creatives, we innately want to do anyways.
Yep. For sure.
Yeah.
No, I totally get that. I mean, again, they are artists in their own right, because whatever they're brewing, it's something new, and whatever they're cooking, it's something they're creating with their hands for other people to enjoy. Mm-hmm. And as artists too, like, yes, we're creating our work because we want to and we love it, or we just have to do it, but we also want other people to enjoy it too, because otherwise, what's the point? So we're all kind of, again, in the same boat. And it's cool that these communities support each other and work together. And whether you're creative in one way or another, somehow you make magic happen. And that's the exciting part about it.
Gotcha. At this point, because, you know, you're balancing doing, again, still a lot of things, even though you've cut back on a school or two. What is something that, like, just that passion project, or that, you know, bucket list client that you would like to work with that you haven't been able to do yet?
Oh, man. I don't know. I don't know if I've ever even thought about having a bucket list client. I think every new thing that I encounter in this business is something that I obviously add to my list of accomplishment. That's a tough one. I don't know if I have one in particular place. I mean, if I could get on a PBR can, that would be pretty sweet.
You know, Miller High Life did a series of artists, cans. I don't know, it's probably been close to 10 years now,
mm-hmm.
but they did a series of artist cans a while back. So I haven't seen PBR do it, but I also don't really look for PBR all that much.
True. They have like a PB art like profile where they spotlight all the different art that comes in. But yeah, I mean, that would be pretty cool. I don't know. I'm always open to whatever. I mean, if somebody wanted to take one of my monsters and make a movie out of it, that would be awesome. But
just call up Guillermo del Toro. He'll find the spot for
perfect. And then they can animate all those strands of spaghetti and all those strips, because I don't want to do that.
But at least you started to go to school for it, so you know how to talk about it.
I know how to do it too. I just don't want to spend my time doing that.
Well, I mean, I know how to do a lot of things that I don't do. It's part of the reason I'm a creative director, is I know how to do a lot of things, but I'm better at telling other people how to do it.
Good point.
I realize in any given day, I am not the best artist in the room.
But you got the ideas. That's what matters.
I've got good ideas.
And you know what looks good.
Yes. I have taste. So that is good. So real quickly, I want to shoot off some rapid fire questions for you. And just, it's usually the first thing that comes to mind. That's the answer I'm looking for.
Oh boy.
So we'll start off going way back. What is like your earliest food memory?
Ice cream. I love ice cream. I would eat ice cream for every single meal.
What was it about ice cream that just, I mean, obviously it's ice cream. It's awesome, but
I don't know. It was so good. And I would just eat it all the time. Not even like one flavor. It was just whatever ice cream was there.
What the listener can't see that I can is the way that your face just changed to like you were almost drooling thinking about it.
Oh, yeah. Ice cream.
Gotcha. What's your go-to comfort food? You're having a shitty day and you just need something in there. What is your go-to comfort food? And it can't be ice cream.
It's Cheez-Its.
Cheez-Its?
Cheez-Its.
Okay. Yes. I can respect that. I like Cheez-Its. Cheez-Its are good.
Cheez-Its.
Gotcha. What is your death row meal? That last meal that you can have?
I'm Italian. So a homemade pizza. Have to be a homemade. With the cornmeal on the bottom, the Parmesan right on the dough, homemade sauce, fresh mutts, some basil. Yeah.
Gotcha. And you're from Connecticut originally, too, right?
Oh, yeah.
So you go for the Connecticut-style pizza,
mm-hmm.
which people don't know that there is a difference. They all think...
There is New Haven-style pizza. If you have not had it, you probably should.
I have not, but I have heard many a good thing about it from friends who live in that area.
Well, if you're ever up this way.
I will make it a point to give you a call and we'll go get some pizza.
Sounds good.
And then since we've been talking a lot about beer, what is your favorite type, style, brand, whatever of beer? And it doesn't have to be a client, but it can be.
I like the IPAs, like the hazy IPAs mm-hmm. That look like orange juice. Mm-hmm. I always go for the double IPA, the high percent alcohol. Oh, yeah, because, you know, I'm a lightweight, so one of those is plenty. Haze from Treehouse, that's a go-to. Alvarium, which is a brewery in New Britain, they have an IPA called Fresh, which is standard. In this household, we always have it in the fridge.
Gotcha.
But yeah, definitely the orange juice hazy IPAs.
Gotcha. I held this up. It's not actually an IPA. It's a Saison, but it's a saffron infused, not filtered Saison that has enough hops in it that it tastes remarkably similar to a hazy IPA.
Nice.
Yeah. So, cool. Well, Maggie, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me. Where can people find out more about you online?
I can be found most easily on Instagram. My handle is at magsart, MAGZART. And my website is my full name, which is a lot of G's, but it's maggiegagliardi.com. And check your spelling because Maggie is spelled MAGGE.
And we'll link to it in the show notes.
So they don't. Yeah.
It'll all be in the show notes. So in case they forget how to spell it, it will pop up.
It's a curse, that name. It's a great name, but it's been something to deal with.
Is there a reason why your parents picked that spelling?
It's because my name is just Maggie. It's not Margaret. On my birth certificate, it's just like an interesting way to spell it that it couldn't be confused with Margaret. Needless to say.
I got to say, I kind of figured that was going to be the story behind it. Because why else would you spell it differently?
No, I don't know. But needless to say, I'm still confused with Margaret. So.
Well, I apologize and I promise I will never call you Margaret.
My friends call me just to piss me off.
I had a feeling you were going to say that too.
It's all good. I'm used to it's not even the Margaret. Some people like don't know how to pronounce it. So it's like Mage or Mage or there's all these weird pronunciations. I've heard it all.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when we started, I had to ask you just to make absolutely sure that it wasn't some weird pronunciation.
Yeah. I probably should just start pronouncing it weird. Mage.
Well, I mean, they call Target Target, so that's you might as well.
Yeah, might as well.
Hell, Target's even started embracing it on their ads. I don't know if you've noticed that.
Yeah. I'll start rebranding now. Yeah, that'll be my new look for 2020.
Awesome. Maggie, thank you so much. And go out and break some bread.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can find out more about Maggie on Twitter at MagsArt, and be sure to check out the links in the show notes for more ways to keep up with her. I hope you like this episode of Feasting on Design. Let me know what you think. And if you like it, leave me a review over on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Visit feastingondesign.com to catch up on the archives of the Creative South podcast. Get some cool swag like t-shirts and stickers that are on sale right now for 50% off with free shipping on orders over $25 when you use the code FREESHIPPING, all one word. Plus, you can keep up with the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Feast on Design. And I'm at Jay Frostholm on Dribbble, Twitter, and Instagram.